This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Bear Boat Alaska, a pure DIY hunting game with one of their 37-foot adventure yachts. You and five of your friends can hunt, fish, set crab pots, shrimp pots, and take DIY to the next level. Bear Boat Alaska is locally owned by a Ketchikan resident who lives here year-round. Call Larry at 907-617-4542 or go to bearboatalaska.com. That's B-A-R-E. boatalaska.com and tell Larry you heard about it on this podcast. Casey McConnell, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, good to be here.
So we're enjoying the last minutes of sunlight here in Southeast Alaska. You're a little bit further north in the rugged northern section of Southeast Alaska. How do you cope with the sun when it sets so much earlier?
It's a tough one. I don't know. Think about sunnier times.
Yeah. It's kind of it's what you have to endure in order to live here. So it's not, I mean, it sometimes feels like it compiles and the years kind of stack on each other. But
yeah,
it's better than traffic. It's better than pollution. It's better than a lot of those other alternatives that people have to deal with if you're living down south or in a different area.
Yeah, for sure. I'll probably get south for a few weeks or maybe a month or so, a little bit later, and get some real sunshine. But yeah, definitely got to think of all the positives.
So what are the positives right now? We still got deer season going on. What are you looking at?
This weekend looks like it's 2 foot or less. So I'm going to hopefully go out and troll for a king. I might spend the night on the boat and go hunt in a few different places that hopefully not too many people have been yet.
Yeah. That's such a tough one. And up there, you don't have much of a road system at all. Prince of Wales has an extensive road system, so it gets hammered. All the easy spots are definitely picked through. Ketchikan has a little bit of a road system. But up there, you don't have much of anything. So if you don't have a boat, you're in kind of trouble, right?
There's actually a pretty good road system here on northern Chichagof. There's, you could go about 30 miles one way, maybe about almost 40 miles the other direction.
Like logging road type trails type stuff.
Yeah. The problem is if we get a lot of snow, you'll get condensed and blocked into just a few areas, and then everyone's hammering that real hard.
Yeah, that's there's some stuff that's under construction here in the Ketchikan area. So there are some roads that you could drive to if the gate was open, if the weather was good, and that makes it pretty tough. But yeah, getting away from people is the key. What kind of boat you got?
I have a 22-foot Tolman skiff, which is a stitch and glue plywood boat. It's my uncle built it in Glenallen and used it up there for a few years, and then I've commandeered it and turned it into a saltwater boat.
Nice. How far are your runs to, not to be too revealing about some of your spots, but are you making long runs across icy, or are you able to kind of pick around some of the areas just around close?
We have Port Frederick, that's about 18 miles to the head, which is fairly protected. So even on days where icy straits pretty rough, it can be nice and calm on the inside. But then if I go out into icy straits, generally stay on the Chichagof shoreline. Mm-hmm. And so maybe 10 miles each way or 15 miles each way.
Yeah. What's the traffic like? Because you're not too far from Juneau. Do you get a bunch of boats coming in from over there?
If they do come over, it's pretty short, or they'll stay at like the 8-fathom bite dock cabin. Or they come over on the ferry, like just put their boat on the trailer. Just because Eastern Icy Straits and Lynn Canal can get so dicey this time of year.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the pressure thing is such a difficult thing to, you know, come to terms with. As hunters, we want to support each other. It's fun to share things. It's fun to, you know, talk with and encourage people online. You know, you have a YouTube channel. I have a YouTube channel. But at the same time, we don't want people in our exact spots, and it makes it kind of tough. So how do you kind of come to terms with, being a local here and sharing, but not oversharing to the point where you're crowding yourself out.
Yeah, I definitely don't post everything. That's one thing. But one of those like pluses about living here is that even crowded for us is not nearly crowded for anywhere else. So the competition or the pressure, even though I might perceive it as like high in the grand scheme of things, pretty low still. And I mean, I've made some mountain hunting videos and a lot of people can figure out exactly where those are. And I don't really mind because, you know, you can't shoot the deer I already shot and good luck getting up there. You know, they still got to put in the work.
Yeah. Most of the time, the people who are going to figure that out are people who probably know about it anyway. And like you said, the deer is already shot. Like someone from down in Wyoming isn't going to watch that video and then go on to OnX or Go Hunt and be able to figure out exactly where it is. That's just not going to be reasonable. And then, like you said, like how are you even going to get up there? The logistical concerns keep it pretty safe anyway.
Yeah. And I'm not the first person to find any of these spots either. There's, you know, guys that are the, you know, half generation above me have watched those videos and said, oh yeah, we used to go back there this way. And they'd tell me the route that they used to get up there, which, you know, maybe now is all brushed in and terrible and I'm going a different way.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about how things have evolved. I know some of the best spots to hunt are clear cuts, and that works for, you know, you got your sweet spot a couple of years after it's been logged, but then when it grows back, that second growth just chokes everything out and, you know, it becomes horrible habitat for hunting. Could be great for deer, but just horrible to be able to see through. And so you have to find the next clear cut access points up roads, looking at logging roads to get you as close to the alpine as possible. Those get water barred, those get washed out. So it's interesting to see how things evolve. Do you you follow Tyler Friel?
A little bit. I kind of knew him the tiny bit when I lived in Fairbanks growing up. My brother and I went to school up there. My parents were teachers in Fairbanks. I follow along a little bit.
Yeah. You see some of his old footage of his dad hunting moose? I think it's his dad. Maybe his grandpa?
Maybe not. I think the last thing that I saw, he was maybe hunting with a longbow. But I don't know. That was a couple years ago.
Yeah. He had some footage of family hunting at the bus, the Chris McCandless bus, that old Fairbanks Transit 142, and how it used to be, you know, where moose hunters would go and they'd stay, or hunters would use that as a shelter. And then, of course, it became the bus, the magic bus, the whatever. But it's really interesting to see some of that vintage footage. And looking at the gear is one thing that, obviously, you got the grainy videos and you got, you know, tons of moose and just the resource is crazy, but also the gear.
Yeah. I can't fathom doing some of the hunts that I do now with the gear from the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s.
Yeah. What do you wear? And then how did you come about it? Cause there's not really the opportunity for us to just go in. I guess you could go to Sportsman's and Juno and try some stuff on, but obviously not in Huna, you're not. So how did you get the stuff that you are wearing?
I just initially, I think I bought Sitka gear just online, I think, or maybe I got it at a store, but basically all I run are rain pant shells over leggings. And even in the summer, I'll just unzip them. And in the winter, maybe a thicker layer or two pairs of leggings, like fleece or something. But yeah, I've sent some stuff back that was too big or too small, just kind of get the feel of it.
Yeah. So you wear, what brand do you wear for the rain gear?
I've gone to Kuyu now.
And why is that? Why did you, was it a big change where you were officially changing from Sitka to Kuyu? What was the...
No, it was just my Sitka gear was starting to wear out and the internal lining was coming off and I decided to just try something different and liked it.
Yeah.
And now
I don't think you can necessarily go wrong, especially in comparison to the old days, but the conditions up here are brutal because it's not just the brushiness and whatnot. It's the wet and dry cycle. You are soaking wet and then dry and then soaking wet and dry. And that's really, really tough on whatever gear it is that you're using.
Oh yeah. Like I've destroyed some hiking boots by just stepping off of a raft, you know, and getting onto the beach and getting salt water on your boots and then drying and then getting fresh water and then drying and then getting salt water and then drying. I think that just really tears through those, the membrane.
Yeah.
So now I'll just wear extra Tufts to and from shore and then lace up once I get on the beach and above the tide line. Mm-hmm. That seems to prolong the life of at least the boots, but yeah, it's tough on everything.
Yeah. It's to say that something fails is very, very relative. And when whatever company comes out with some brand new, really expensive technology, I'm like, okay, that's nice. But if I want to be waterproof, I got to wear the Grundons because the Grundons, I mean, you're going to sweat, but at least you're going to be dry from its heat or its condensation. It's not soaked from the outside. If you're soaked from the outside, that's a different wet, and you're not going to dry that out. If you stop walking when you've been in Grundons for a little bit, if you're in the bibs and the jacket, you stop walking, you get a little vented air, you're going to be dry again. But if you're soaked because the membrane or whatever breaks down, then you're toast.
Yeah, if there's more humidity on the inside than the outside, you just can't overcome that.
Yeah. Do you ever wear Grundon's bibs or anything like that?
Very rarely. I've actually, instead of wearing Grundon's bibs, I'll wear my Sims waders.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if that's actually better or not, but they're lighter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the commercial grade or that, what's their Hercules or whatever, that's a real thick, that's a super aggressive, you know, crab boat type thing. So there's some lighter ones that aren't as bad, but yeah, the waders aren't going to breathe. You'll get the condensation, but you know, you sit for a little bit, some of that stuff will evaporate and you'll be dry. And you don't have to worry about where you sit or if you need to put your knee into the side of a hill to get up. It's so much nicer. If you do that with Gore-Tex pants, you're wet.
Yeah. And actually I did wear my rubber gear the other day, and I've got this stuff that's a knockoff brand. Let me see here. It's called Granite Gear, Granite with a Y. And it was like $20 for a top and a $20 for a bottom. And it's fairly lightweight and it stretches a little bit. It's definitely not what I wear if I was going to be like crabbing or anything, but it's pretty good for hiking around. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's only $20. So if it fails, I could get four more pairs for the price of, you know, Grundons.
Yeah. And it's not the Frog Tog $20. I had some buddies that came up here to fish in the Frog Tog and it was just,
oh, that stuff like shreds.
Yeah. I think the expensive type stuff is real, but the inexpensive Frog Tog stuff is just one small step up from the ponchos that the tourists wear.
Yeah.
What else is like an indispensable gear? I'm kind of in gear mode right now. I usually spend money on new gear in February when not a whole lot's going on. We got steelhead season, but so I'm looking at stuff and looking at shopping, but there's been a lot of deals that I've been looking at because we got Black Friday coming up shortly. So what are some indispensable Southeast Alaska products that you think are, well, indispensable?
Well, I know you and I talked briefly about hot tents a while ago. That I'm a convert on that.
Oh man.
Just because everything is so wet, you either have to carry all your dry spares or you can carry a hot tent and then everyone can get dry. So when I did the Edelin Island elk hunt, that was a game changer. We weathered two atmospheric rivers in it and it was great.
Yeah. Spending the hours in there, I'm sure you've been in more than one small tent where everything is wet and you're just waiting out the weather. Being able to wait it out, and it gives you something to do too. You're sawing the wood, chopping the wood, whatever, you're feeding the fire. It's just a huge mental release, or just it's so much better to kill the time doing that.
Oh, yeah. And we got back to the boat or the beach where we're going to get picked up early, and we set that up and created a sauna. And just took a hot, took a sauna in the hot tent. It was fantastic.
Which one do you have?
I've got the, I can't remember. Seek Outside Cimarron, I think. Okay. It's a Redcliffe, the bigger one.
Okay. Nice.
So four people can sleep in it, or like two is a palace with the stove. If the stove is in there, four people have a difficult time laying down around it.
Mm-hmm. I saw a knockoff brand, and I thought, if you're going to make a hot tent, you have to do that correctly. Because if you skimp on some material that is going to ignite, that's not good. I'm not sure a $20 hot tent is a good route to go. So that's something you definitely got to pay for. It's either going to leak or catch on fire, and those are things that you can't have happen.
Yeah, without a shelter, you're screwed.
Have you been in? What about like safety type stuff? Whenever I go to shore, I like to take a dry bag with just an extra pair of socks, some extra fire making material, because everything gets so wet, it's impossible to really make a fire. And just some other kind of goodies to bring to shore. I have an InReach. It's an old one from when it was DeLorme. What are some things that you take with you for safety?
I've got a full set of puffy pants and a down jacket. And then I'll bring a full set of rain gear separate.
Mm-hmm. Are they Kuyu puffy?
I've got the Stone Glacier ones.
Oh, how do you like those?
The puffy pants are the cat's meow. I bought those on a sheep hunt, and that was like our evening treat, was to sit down and wear puffy pants around camp.
I got some bargain old ones that are Sitka, and I hate using the term game changer, but it's so nice to be able to just be warm in those evenings when you're glassing, but you just can't get wet. And you can't walk through brush, but that's not what they're meant for. You got to use the appropriate use for them. But it's nice also if you're just kind of sitting around and it is chilly, you can put them in there and stay warm.
Yeah, I was wearing my just my Crocs, which with a waterproof sock, and that is kind of loose and lets my feet dry out pretty good. That was a pretty nice little thing. And then my Crocs are not true Crocs. They're made by Vivo Barefoot, and they're even lighter weight than Crocs.
Oh.
So that was pretty nice to have on the sheep hunt and around camp too. I'm just looking through some gear here I'm kind of in my gear shed right now. I always bring the jet boil ashore and a couple Mountain House, just because even if I'm just waiting for someone else to get out of the woods, it's just nice to just fire one up and eat it.
Mm-hmm. What jet boil do you have?
I've got it's in the boat right now, but it's the it's not the flash one. It's like the I can't remember now. It's the little square one, the Mini Sumo or something, I think. Mm.
Yeah, those are awesome. I have a couple of buddies that have MSR ones, pocket rocket, whatnot, but those little stoves are great. You just absolutely have to have them with you. But the jet boil is just such a nice, easy, convenient one to use.
Yeah, it's the Mini Mo. I've got those pocket rockets, and I have this old titanium stove that is made by a company called Ola Camp, I think. Then they had gone out of business, and I got one on eBay. That one's pretty nice. It has a little hose and a stand, and the tank is off to the side. Mm. And you can get it nice and low to the ground, that is, it was pretty sweet. I took that on a sheep hunt in 2015.
How often do you turn over your gear? You mentioned that you went from Sitka to Kuyu. Is it just when stuff wears out, or do you kind of look at your Jetboil stuff and think, oh, you know, this is fine, this works, but I'm really intrigued by this? How often do you get caught up in newer and better and let's buy this thing?
I basically run it till it breaks, or if I don't like it, then I'll just get something new. But if I like something, I'll just keep using it. Mm-hmm. I did get, Kuyu came out with a super lightweight rain gear, and then they discontinued it, and I had grabbed a pair, and it's lighter than any of the stuff they currently make, and I'm going to keep a hold of it. It's great as like a backup set.
Yeah, it's good to have that stuff.
Yeah, so I took that on a goat hunt as just my backup rain gear. Uh-huh.
How does your gear vary from hunt? You've done obviously blacktail, mountain goat, sheep, moose. Are there some consistent things no matter what you're hunting, where you're going? Or is it kind of like a, yeah, almost have a separate thing for each hunt?
No, I pretty much wear the same stuff. I've got the Chugach pants and top for the rain gear. And then I've got some sort of it says Attack Pro on it. Those are the kind of my pants that I'll wear if it's going to be really dry, because they're just it just has a water resistant barrier, not a actual membrane. Mm-hmm. And that, those have some pockets and they're a little heavier, so if I'm going to do a mountain hunt, I'm just going to wear the lightest. But I guess I wore these Attack Pro ones or whatever, chukar hunting and quail hunting a few years ago. That was pretty good for that because it's dry, very dry down there.
I really like that. A couple of buddies of mine have the Attack pants, and being able to vent on the side is really awesome because there's the mesh in there. Mm-hmm. And so when you open up, you're not putting yourself at mosquito risk. I have the Stone Glacier de Havilland pants that you can zip down, which is great. But if you don't have the mesh, then, you know, you're venting heat, but you're inviting bugs in, and that's not great.
How much blood do you want to give away?
Yeah. What about footwear and socks and whatnot? I found with the mountain hunting, I go obviously with my boots, but there are times when I use a lot more of the Grundin's boots when I'm doing some of the rut hunts around here to keep the feet dry. Sometimes I'll run boots with gaiters and then the Grundin's bibs. What about that?
I have had terrible problems with just my feet being sore and rubber boots and extra tufts. I haven't tried like the muck boots or those Grundin's, but I just go back to my Tibet Pro by Loa. And this time of year when it's really wet, I'll continuously spray them or seal skin them every couple of days or every couple of uses. Mm-hmm. And then I wear a like smart wool liner sock and then seal skins waterproof sock. And so far my feet have not suffered because of wetness or chafing or blistering or anything in the boot. That was nice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's an accepted level of misery, and it's, if you expect it, it makes it a lot easier when it happens. If you think that you're going to be dry and comfortable and then you're not, all of a sudden you're kind of on a, the clock is ticking against you. But if you kind of know that you set yourself up as good as you possibly can, knowing that there's a good chance that it's going to fail, I think that's kind of a good mindset to maybe have, that you're not immune to bad things happening. You're not immune to cold or wetness creeping in.
Yeah. If you're ready for it, it definitely doesn't affect you as much.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I just can't stand like cold hands or cold feet. After a little while of either one of those, I'm done.
Yeah. I have a box of those hot hands by the door. So every time we leave, just grab a couple of those. And they're great, but you know, people talk about how you could put them in your boots and they're going to dry out your boots, and they will if it's condensation that's got your feet wet. But if your boots are soaked through or your socks are soaked through, those things are not going to dry anything out.
Oh yeah,
they're awesome to have, but once they're wet, like it's, they're not going to do what you want them to do. So if you're counting on starting fresh and anew in the morning because you put those in your boots, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, definitely. They won't. There's no BTUs in there.
So what's your favorite hunt? I'm assuming it's going to be one that puts you pretty close to the misery level.
My favorite hunt that I've done, or
mm-hmm. Yeah, let's go favorite hunt. And then hunt that you want to do.
In 2020, I did a 14-day sheep hunt in the Brooks, which ended kind of in a heartbreak of got close to the rams. And then they were 7 years old and 15/16 curl, not legal. And that was the 100th mile and 20,000th foot climbed.
Jeez.
It's just like, okay, we're done. Up until that point was super fun. And I've done a few trips down to Prince of Wales that have been very fun, deer hunting as well.
Yeah. On that sheep hunt, were you with someone who was used to gauging sheep? How was that?
No, I don't think Ben was my hunting partner for that one. He was a teacher here. And he had never seen a doll sheep before.
Oh.
So I had gone on one previous sheep hunt and got to see several rams and was able to judge them. Basically just looked at a bunch of pictures, looked at a bunch of videos, and, you know, decided to, I wanted a ram that was going to be legal plus a little bit just to give me a little buffer. Mm-hmm. And the ones that we found were not quite.
Yeah, I think that's huge to be able to, if you've been up through the Brooks Range once, because it's just this kind of menacing thing up there. It's the Brooks, you know, it's the top of Alaska. And if you've never been on a sheep hunt, not really knowing what to expect and how to gauge and how to measure and what to look for and the angles and things like that, I think would be really difficult to do. So I've only been up and over the Brooks to go on a caribou hunt, but I've never been on a sheep hunt. So I think it'd be really tough to, you know, put yourself in that position. And then good on you for judging that, all right, they're pretty close, but I'm not going to risk it because I think some people might get the, well, I'm owed this because, you know, I put in all this time and all this whatever. And so, you know, you start to look for what you wish was there rather than what's actually there.
Yeah. I took some pictures and video and sent it to a guide and a state trooper, and they both said the same thing. So I was glad that we didn't shoot anything.
Yeah, for sure. Did you do a flyout or were you off the road?
We hiked off the road. Yeah.
Seeing some of those areas, man, it was pretty intense to imagine how you would actually get up that. You can do all the e-scouting you want. I did quite a bit of it because my buddy and I were planning on if we're going to go caribou, if we're going to go doll sheep, and, you know, just looking at stuff and says, oh, yeah, you could probably get up here and probably get up here. But when you look at some of those areas, you think there's no, it's impossible. No one could get up there. And so when you're looking at the bottom there, trying to find a line to be able to access that and seems pretty, it's doable, but pretty tough. What was the difference between expectation and reality when you got up there and saw what you had scouted?
There was some pretty intimidating stuff. And we climbed some stuff that I didn't think we were going to climb for looking at it from across the valley. I was like, well, we'll just have to pick our way around that or go way up and around. And we ended up just going straight up it. coming down was worse. As far as mountains go, the Brooks Range, I think, is pretty tame. I mean, most of the mountains that, even though it was rugged and nasty, it's easier to climb than some of the ones around here. in Huna.
Yeah, I did see some of that. That I don't know if it's expectation. If you think Brooks Range, I mean, that's sheep country. That's, you know, the north. Everything is just more extreme up there. But southeast, with these glacial carved areas, there's so many of those monolithic faces, and you're picking your way through sheer cliffs, whereas you might have a lot of scree and might have some definite sharp areas up in the Brooks. They're not, mm-hmm. It's not like hiking in the Appalachian Mountains or anything.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely places on the southeast mainland that are completely impassable for miles and miles, that it's just no-go zones.
Well, even Chichagof and Baranof, like though that almost looks like an extension of mainland. It just comes down there, and I mean, it looks like it's just all Glacier Bay almost. There's kind of a gentle taper, I guess, but that's some real rugged stuff, especially Chichagof.
Yeah, there's a little spine on the kind of outside of Chichagof, like between Pelican and between Pelican and Elfin Cove, and down towards Tenneke, that's pretty gnarly. Mm-hmm. I think it's just because there's a lot of exposed rock and not a lot of understory or timber.
Yeah, that exposed rock is kind of you look at that, and that can be kind of the intimidating thing, but like, you don't have to climb up that. Like, we're going around that. That's not a big deal. It's you're going to be fine.
Yeah. Well, when the sheep are trying to go in spots like that,
yeah,
that's how they get safe.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'd like to, at some point, definitely go on a sheep hunt. It's just a matter of where. What about the hunt that you do want to go on that you haven't gone?
Well, I'm planning another sheep hunt for this coming summer. I've been applying for a couple tags, sheep tags, for a long time. I probably will never draw them, but that's fine.
Of course.
The one hunt that I want to do is elk during the bugle down in somewhere in the lower 48.
Yeah.
Which is why I got into bow hunting. It's because that's kind of the season for that.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. That's what I want to do next year. I've been buying points in Wyoming. And when my wife was down there getting her PhD, we did a couple hunts last year. I went down there in late September, and we kind of missed the rut, which is too bad. She went out there by herself, and she heard them bugling at night and then a couple times during the day, and she called one in but just wasn't able to get a good shot. So I thought, oh, this is going to be perfect. I'm going to go down there. I'll set up behind. I will call one in for her, and she's going to get it with a bow. It's going to be perfect. But there had been so much pressure that they had gone silent. And I thought, gosh, dang it. So we had two encounters, they'd gone quiet. So we had no idea where they were. We couldn't locate. There was nothing going on at night. But the previous year I'd been down there and hearing bugle at night, it's unlike any. It's everything that people talk about when they say there's nothing like an elk bugle. I'm like, yeah, that's true. There's also nothing like, you know, a mountain goat hunt. But yeah, that's a whole different program, and that's a whole lot of fun. But planning that right in the archery season, when you can get them coming in, that's awesome. I'm excited to hopefully spend my tag and do that hunt.
Yeah, I've got 3 points now for Wyoming.
Wow, excellent. That's good. Yeah, it's people talk about premium tags and you know, saving up for points to get a really good spot, but man, if you can just get an opportunity, just go down there and experience it. I mean, it's pretty expensive. You don't want to just blow it on anything, but you know, if you're going to go down there and you're going to do the hunt right and make it, get your money's worth, and shoot, just get yourself the opportunity rather than try to wait 10 years for the perfect thing or draw the perfect tag.
Yeah, I'd rather do two hunts in 10 years than one hunt.
Exactly.
For sure. Yeah.
What else are you looking forward to?
I am going to try to do some more goat hunting on the mainland next summer too. I've been pounding the alpine around here pretty hard for deer with my bow, and it's been a struggle. And I think next summer I'm going to shift gears a little bit and just try something different. Probably not with my bow. I'll rifle hunt for goats. Mm-hmm.
You've gotten a couple with your rifle, right?
One so far.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's good to have that mixed bag in the freezer when you got different experiences. But it's hard too sometimes. I didn't get my first deer this year until 2 weeks ago, because I spent the opener in the first 10 days of the hunting season up hunting caribou. And so that's why I didn't get that awesome alpine deer experience that I love, because I was up caribou hunting. And you don't want to switch, you know, and I certainly don't regret doing the caribou, but man, you only have kind of one season, and sometimes they overlap and you have to make choices. It's like a great decision or an awesome decision, but
yeah,
we're pretty lucky.
Yeah, August and September go by too fast. There's not enough days in the week. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I traded my, I guess, first right of refusal to my friends. I took a guy that had never gone hunting before and his partner and their niece, and then another buddy came up, a former grad student. That lives in Washington. He came up and then basically tried to get them deer for the first couple times. I didn't shoot my first buck this year till this past Friday, so just a couple days ago.
It's funny how that happens, but you know, it just does happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, what do you do? The only thing you should really regret would be that if you didn't hunt for some ridiculous reason. Which is probably not going to happen, so you can't really worry about it. You make your choices and you live with them.
Yeah, I traded October hunting for and October fishing and duck hunting for moose hunt in Fairbanks, and then winter king fishing in Homer. So that was a good trade, but a trade. Yeah.
Was that Fairbanks hunt an over the counter, or was it a draw?
That was a draw, antlerless archery tag.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. It was
there's a lot of good hunt opportunities, I guess I should say. Have you already put in your stuff for the draw?
No, I've talked to a couple buddies and trying to figure out what they're doing and what I have time for.
Mm-hmm.
I'll keep applying for my sheep spots, and then I don't think I'm going to apply for any moose or anything else. I still have moose from 2021 in the freezer. Now I have part of a moose from 2022. I don't know.
Yeah. It's tough to gauge that, because you could spend the money that you would on some sort of fly out or some sort of exotic other trip. Not that Wyoming is necessarily exotic, but you could spend that money on an over-the-counter Alaska hunt.
Oh, yeah.
Or you could try to do something else. And so if you don't really win the draw, it doesn't really matter a whole lot. If you drew a dull sheep tag, then you, of course, do what you need to do to make that happen. But if you don't draw it, you could then spend that money on a really good over-the-counter something else in Southeast or another different experience, which would be – that's all good. I think my problem this year is going to be deciding what to prioritize as far as that Wyoming hunt. Am I going to put in for some awesome draws? Because I won't find out about them until I have to decide if I want to prioritize elk. Because the elk application closes before we get results from the Alaska tag. So I probably won't be able to do both. So we'll kind of see.
Yeah. I'm fortunate in that my work window kind of closes mid-September, and then I have all late fall to do whatever. And in reality, I can kind of block off days here and there in the summer as well if I need to.
Yeah.
So
more time off, more time off you have, the easier it is to spend money.
Yeah, that's the problem, is when money goes out instead of coming in. And
yeah.
It can go out really fast.
Yeah. Well, what else you got, man? We've been rapping for a little bit here. What, as far as maybe recommendations or anything, what does northern Southeast Alaska have that I'm missing out on down here in southern Southeast Alaska?
I don't know. The grass is always greener. I always wish we had a winter steelhead or a fall steelhead. We don't really have that. I guess if you like brown bear hunting, there's brown bear hunting here. They're still awake.
Yeah, I saw that picture you posted on Instagram. That was
Yeah, I checked out that spot yesterday to see if there was any people tracks into it, and there wasn't. So I was like, great, I'll go there first thing in the morning, hunt for a few hours, and then be able to get back for a little bit of afternoon work and a phone call with you. And I got there, and there was fresh bear tracks of a big one. Never mind.
Yeah. Do you have run-ins at all? Is the population quality and steady, or is the population getting a little bit high? Where are you at with that?
It seems like there's a lot. I haven't had any issues with them this year or in the last few years, but people have been seeing them, and they're on the roads, and they're still cruising.
That is such a nice thing on a lot of the hunts that we don't do down here for deer, is that we don't have the brown bears. And it's just nice to, you make your camp, you know, you set your meat off to the side there, but you're not worried about electric fences. You're not worried about a lot of the things that you would be if you were in brown bear territory.
Yeah. Like, we don't even call, I won't blow a deer call for probably more than 7 or 8 minutes. I know there's pages and pages on the for hunting forums of how long to call deer and stuff, but I'd get pretty nervous calling for more than 10 minutes.
Yeah. No, actually that would kind of fit my, I move probably a little bit too fast, too quick. I'm a 15 to 20 minute, and then I'm gone to the next spot. So I would really love that as an excuse to, I'm just hunting the right program, but yeah, that's because of bears, not because of impatience.
Yeah, I'm not very patient either, so it works for me too.
It's just hard to be. If you're in one of those areas that you chose it because it looks like a good spot. So if there's nothing there, you know, moving and seeing it from different angles and see if you actually got something up moving around that didn't necessarily come running in. That's just kind of always where my brain goes. Rather than be patient, have it come all the way in, I'm thinking, man, the other side of this or in between this little area here on the edge of the timber, those sort of areas really start looking good. And I think, man, I gotta get up and walk through this, because if I got something up and it didn't come all the way in, or I just, my brain goes right there and I'm up within 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah, it might be moving and you can see it now or something. Or maybe the deer came in halfway and then wouldn't commit, but now it's in your zone.
Yeah.
Hard to say.
I had a buddy who put a GoPro on his downrigger and was watching how many king salmon would show up close to the bait and just not take. And so, you know, you're trolling and you're thinking, oh, there's nothing here. They're not biting, man. But there are so many things that look at it. You just wonder how many eyes of deer you're missing, because they don't quite come clear, they can't quite see, or, you know, they just hang up for whatever reason. And kind of goes back to that patience thing, man. If I would have waited 10 more minutes, it would have been there. But you keep doing that, all of a sudden you don't go anywhere else. And had you gone somewhere else, then you would have picked one up. But I don't know. That's hunting, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've done the GoPro thing too. It was disheartening. It was depressing.
Yeah. Sometimes I don't want to know. I just want to think, you know, I'm making the right call. This is the decision. I got to live with it, rather than have the results of my impatience.
Mm-hmm.
All right, man. It was great. Great talking with you. Where can people find your YouTube channel and Instagram and all that stuff?
My YouTube, I think, is Tideline to Alpine. All one word. There's a van life person that has the same name with spaces. Nice. And then Casey_fishes or Casey.fishes on Instagram.
Nice. And then you have a link to your YouTube channel from there. So in case they can't find the YouTube, they can go to your Instagram and they can go from there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess it is.
Excellent. Yeah. Thanks, man. Good talking with you. Good luck with the rest of the season. Have fun.
Yeah, I'll let you know how tomorrow goes. Try a different place that doesn't have as much bear activity.
Yeah, sounds good. Good luck, man.
All right, thanks.
All right, see you.
Yeah.